You are listening to a sermon by Janice Kreider, recorded on Sunday, March 8, 2009, at the Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Our neighbors have been away for a couple of weeks, and so they asked us to get their mail. And they subscribed to The Atlantic. And I saw that there was an article about Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury there, and I saw that there was a quote that he gave about Christian faith. And because I was intending to speak about Abraham's faith, this caught my eye. And I'd like to begin with this quote from Rowan Williams. Christian faith has its beginnings in an experience of profound contradictoriness. So the church should proclaim a hidden God who does not uncover his will in a straight line of development, but fully enters into a world of confusion and ambiguity and works in contradictions. Lent is a time where we look at our own faith, look at our own spirituality, our own righteousness, and each of us has our own journey. Unlike Abraham, we have a lot to draw on. We have all the history of religion, history of Christianity. We have the institutional church. We have all kinds of theologians. But it's interesting to go back and look at what Abraham's faith was like, what his spirituality was like, because he didn't have all these things to draw on. And he's really the beginning of our Christian faith, the Jewish faith, and the Muslim faith. The Romans passage speaks of his faith, so it still is a big thing of interest in by Paul. Now, Abraham probably grew up with regional gods, but the family moved a lot, so they may have been left behind. And at times, he seemed to hear this voice of a superior being talking to him, as we have in chapter 17, and as we have in Genesis 12, when he heard a voice, "Leave your country." Now, he had a few rituals, not very many. I think many people in that area probably practiced offering burnt sacrifices, and he did that. Later in chapter 17, he's instructed to practice male circumcision. His story is told without moralizing. Now, when we look at what he did, we might say, well, I don't think it was such a good idea that he lent his wife to a couple of rulers he was afraid of. I don't think it was such a good idea to send Hagar and Ishmael out into the desert with not very many provisions. But the Bible doesn't say that was bad. We look at some of his deeds and we say, well, they make sense to us. When he gave Lot the better land to go to with his animals, there was a conflict over a well, and he was able to resolve that peacefully and generously. When he had quite a sense of injustice, and when he thought that some righteous people were going to be punished unjustly, when their cities would be destroyed, he pled for their welfare. So when we read in Romans that Abram's faith was reckoned to him as righteousness, is it because he did the good deeds? Is it because his good deeds were bigger than his bad deeds? I don't think so. I don't think it refers at all to his deeds, but to something different, something deeper. It's interesting in the Old Testament, people's ideas of what God was like, the superior being, they evolved. And the characteristics of the superior being are revealed throughout the Bible. And along with that is the name that people give to this superior being. Now Moses, with the burning bush story, the superior being reveals himself to Moses and said, I'm the God of your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's not good enough for Moses. He needs to know the name of this God because he has to go and talk to the people. So he he questions and gets the name, and it's I am who I am, or I will be who I will be. It's sort of like being with a capital B-E-I-N-G. And in our Bibles, that's written down as Lord with all caps, L-O-R-D, or sometimes called Yahweh. Now, this name for God started in Exodus, but why do we find it in Genesis? Well, because I'm kind of making this up, but this is what the books say too. You know, the people who wrote Genesis knew that it was Yahweh in Genesis. The people in Genesis didn't know it was I am who I am and I will be who I will be, because things were evolving. But sometimes the Yahweh is put back into Genesis, even though it didn't really begin until then. There are other names that are used for God, and one of them is by Hagar. And when she's mistreated by Sarah and is sent off, she escapes to the desert this time, and she has a spiritual experience with an angel, and she recognizes in that experience that there's a superior being involved here. There's some power involved. And she wants to name this being, and she names this being the God who sees. Now, this isn't the God who sees that the way we might think of it is a God who sees our good deeds, sees our bad deeds, and starts tallying them up like a Santa Claus. This is a God who sees when you're at the end of your rope and when you don't know where you're going to turn next. Sometimes it's a God who sees me, the way it's translated. And this is a very comforting idea of God to have. Sometimes the word God in Genesis is the generic word for God tacked onto something that means most high, so we get the idea of God most high, the highest God that there is, and that makes some sense too. But in verse 1 of chapter 17, we actually have two kind of gods there. One of them is Yahweh, but the one that's translated as God Almighty is something else. And I've got the Hebrew for it. I don't know how to pronounce it. I don't know if we have any Hebrew scholars here anyway. It's El for God, and then Shaddai, S-H-A-D-D-A-I. That's how I'm going to say it. And it's in the Old Testament 48 times, but about half of those times it's in Job, or maybe more than half of those times it's in Job. So it doesn't appear all the time, but it's sprinkled throughout, and I'll give you some of the places where it is. Genesis 28:3. This is when Jacob charges Isaac not to marry one of those Canaanite women. And so Isaac says, "May El Shaddai bless you and make you fruitful and numerous, that you may become a company of peoples." In Genesis 35:11, this is when Jacob's name is changed to Israel, sort of like Abram's name changed to Abraham. "I am El Shaddai, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall spring from you." And then Genesis 49, and this is when Jacob is blessing his sons. And he blesses all of them, and the last one to bless is Joseph, and he actually gets quite poetic and gives Joseph the best blessing. And I'll read a couple of verses that Jacob says here. "Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. El Shaddai will bless you with the blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb." And then we have this word used in Ruth, the first chapter. And these are words of Naomi when she's going back to her country with a couple of daughter-in-laws. "Call me no longer Naomi, call me Mara, for El Shaddai has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but Yahweh has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when Yahweh has dealt harshly with me and El Shaddai has brought calamity upon me?" Yeah, the two different words for God are used in that conversation there. Now, you can probably guess these passages that I read so far. El Shaddai is often used in connection with fertility, with descendants, and with not being barren. And so I think it's when they're talking about that kind of thing, then they use that term for God. And it's a bit oversimplified. But the other times it's used in the New Testament, aside from Job, is one time by Balaam, and then in Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Joel, it's used about four times. And there it's talking about destruction, and destruction is in a way the opposite of descendants. People are being killed off. And then one time in the Psalms, Psalm 91:1, who abide in the shadow of El Shaddai. So that's a little bit, we don't know what that might refer to. So I'm going to leave that for the moment and go off and talk about the land. Now, verse 8 of Genesis 17 was not in the lectionary, and it would have been great just to, you know, go with the lectionary and not look at verse 8. But I decided to look at verse 8 because it's a problem, and it's something to think about. I will give to you and your offspring after you the land where you are now an alien, and all the land of Canaan for a perpetual holding, and I will be their God. Now, many of you were here on February 1st when John Funk spoke, and even if you weren't here, you know about the complex situation in Israel, and he was there with Christian peacemaker teams. So that's why this verse is a problem, because many people believe that land should be the land for the Jews for forever and ever. Now, I'm not going to solve that problem by these comments, but I've got eight different comments getting at the idea of the land and Abraham from, you know, different points of view. So the first one is about the land and nature in general. And they are often the beginnings of spirituality and the beginnings of recognizing the possibility of a superior being and maybe even a creator. And as a child, I grew up in the country, so at night the sky was quite bright and it was possible to see many stars. So this was a source of wonder to me and gave me one of my earliest senses of being small in a part of something bigger. The ocean, which I didn't meet up until later in life, gives me a sense of permanence and change. And the changing of the seasons and growing things, it gives me a sense of the cycles of life. Now, all of this is the beginning of spirituality, and a lot of people experience these things. And you can get an awareness of what a superior being might be like, but as Christians, of course, we go a lot further than that. But at least it's a beginning, and I think it's a positive thing to, if people even have that experience. So you can imagine Abraham, he didn't have much tradition to draw on, and he would wake up each morning and step out of his tent onto the land, and there would be a sunrise. And he would see the expanse of the land, or perhaps he would see the hills closing in around him, depending on where he was at the time. And he moved from place to place. But even when they were in Egypt, where they were even more alien than they were in Canaan, there was always a physical and daily tie to the land, to plants and to animals. And that's in contrast to some of us here who might live in a high rise with no pets and only a few potted plants. Our connection with the land isn't nearly as close as Abraham's was. Now, my second comment here, Abraham moved to Canaan. When he moved to Canaan, he used the land for his animals, but it wasn't a formal ownership as we understand it. And he recognized that it belonged to others more than it belonged to him. When Sarah died, he wanted to honor her in her death. So he paid good money to Ephron to acquire a cave to bury her. But the ownership of that plot was not for profit-making. So the third comment, as before, Abraham used the land, but he did not abuse it. When he and Lot were together, and the land, the verse says, the land could not support both of them, and that almost sounds like a 21st century phrase. Well, Abraham suggested that they spread out more, and generously he let Lot take the valley land, which was greener and had more moisture. The fourth comment, Abraham was not tied to a specific part of the land, probably because he had experienced so many moves. And they went to Egypt when there was a famine. But he did set up altars in several places, and in a way maybe that's being tied to those particular spots. He had a well, or maybe probably more. But he wasn't tied to one small parcel of land, and that probably helped him expand his concept of God as being a superior being rather than being a regional God. My fifth comment is relationships with others appeared to be more important to Abraham than grabbing land. And I've mentioned that he let Lot have the better land, and when there was the conflict over a well, it was settled peacefully and with a lot of extra generosity on the part of Abraham. When he paid for the cave, he gave probably more money than he was expected to give. And at one point, Lot was dragged off. Lot was in the wrong place at the wrong time and got dragged off with some kings, or I don't know, it was kind of a complicated thing. And Abraham went after him to rescue him. And Abraham was offered spoils, and he declined them and said, I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me, and he names three men. Let them take their share. So he wasn't taking anything for himself, but he was trying to make it fair for the people who were working for him. And aside from that reference to going after Lot, and there was probably a little warfare there, I don't know, a little violence, who knows. But there are no other stories of him getting involved in violence or conflict. Now, the sixth comment, who wrote Genesis? Okay, we're going to solve this today. Years ago, and when we were children, we all were taught that Moses wrote Genesis, so that's because that was our tradition. But many people don't believe that anymore. And I was reading something that a professor at Fuller talked about. His name is John Goldingay, and I figure he's not a way out liberal. And this is what he says. Is that scholars in this century are even more confused about who wrote Genesis and Exodus than they were in the 20th century. In the 20th century, the idea came that Genesis, you know, you read it and then it starts over again with the story, and you go to Chronicles and it starts over again. So you know there are several manuscripts coming together here, and they use different words for God, and the stories are a little bit different, but they're basically the same. And so they got the idea there were four different traditions coming together, but now they don't even know if they can believe that. So, and he's saying, we probably will never know who wrote it. But it's there. It's there. And it's obviously based on some kind of oral tradition, but where that oral tradition came from and who wrote it down, why they wrote it down, when they wrote it down, it's murky. Now, a possibility is that it could have been put together in the time of David or in the time of exile. And if the story was put together at that time, written down, we know at that time Israel had its land. It was the homeland. In David's time, they were fighting for it, trying to expand it and keep it. In the time of the exile, they wanted to go back to it, and it was their land already. So maybe the idea that the land belonged to them was sort of extrapolated back to Abraham's time in a stronger way than it was ever there at the beginning. Who knows? I mean, this is all conjecture on my part. And well, it's not conjecture on my part. This is what some scholars are thinking. But we have the advantage of the whole Bible to look at, and some archaeology too. Now, this is one where you can, my seventh point, you can challenge me on this one. Remember the words for God used in Genesis 17:1, the word for God, El Shaddai, with its connotation of fertility. And I would like to suggest that this is my idea, that for Abraham, fertility was more of his worry, his concern, his problem, than the land. And of course, if you have lots of children, you need lots of space. So you might worry about that. But I have an idea that he and Sarah were more concerned that they didn't have any children of their own. So that what if the meaning of verse 8 is less like, this land will be for you and your descendants forever, but it's more like, there will be a place for you and your many descendants, and I will be there for you. There are three ideas in verse 8, the land, the descendants, and I will be your God. And what is the most important there? It's something to ponder. In the my eighth point, I'm flipping over to the New Testament in this one. Who gets the land in the New Testament? Well, in the New Testament, they don't talk about the land in that way. There is talk about land, possessing land, and there's a lot of talk about possessions and the rich and the poor. We have the verse in the Beatitudes about the meek inheriting the earth. And then we have the verse that we read today in Mark, what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? The land is really not the important thing in the New Testament, but giving up selfish behavior seems to be more important. And Abraham can serve as a model. He's not in the New Testament, but he can serve as a model because he emphasized relationships with people, peaceful relationships with people, more than claiming land or abusing the land. Now back to the verse in Romans that connects us back to Genesis about Abraham's faith being credited to him as righteousness. Walter Brueggemann, in his commentary on Genesis, says that the ones who are barren and hopeless become the practitioners of faith. We see that in the story of Abraham, who was very concerned about their fertility. We see that in many other stories. People who came to Jesus to be healed or have their children healed. In contrast, Jesus several times called his disciples men of little faith. These are the people closest to Jesus. He calls them men of little faith. So I'd like to quote something from Brueggemann about faith. Faith responds to an already given grace. This faith is not simply an embrace of the goodness which meets us in the world, but a reception of the goodness of God promised in spite of the way the world is. The faith of Abraham is not anything he sees in the world, but in a word which will overcome the barrenness of the world. Faith is reliance on God's promise of overcoming the present for a new life. And then I'd like to quote a couple things from John Stott's commentary on Romans. What God said to Abraham was not, obey this law and I will bless you, but I will bless you, believe my promise. Faith's exclusive function is to humbly receive what grace offers. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. we know that in Abraham's story, he does not get all his promises fulfilled. And he's actually even told that you're not going to see your descendants inherit the land. In John Funk's talk on February 1st, he stressed something he called a faith-based hope on the part of the Arab shepherd who struggled with the drought and with the harassment of the Jewish settlers. And this faith-based hope, this term faith-based hope, I think is a good way of describing Abraham's faith that was credited to him for righteousness. And I'd like to quote another thing from Rowan Williams about faith, about how he would describe the life of faith. Human actions that seek to be open to God's action. Human actions that seem to be open to God's action. I think that resonates with Anabaptists because we're all doers, right? The idea of grace or gift still comes through with that definition, because we don't know what God's actions will be, and they are gifts to us. When we pray, "Thy kingdom come," but we know in our hearts that in our own lifetime, we're not expecting to see a clear and straight path of the development of God's kingdom. I think then we are also expressing our faith-based hope. With the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus and all the other teachings in the New Testament and later, we have a lot more background for faith than Abraham had. I'd like to close with the last two verses in Romans. Now the words that we read, verses that we read then, now the words, "it was reckoned to Abraham," were written not for his sake alone, but for ours also. "It will be reckoned to us who believe in God, who raised Jesus our Lord from the dead, who was handed over to death for our trespasses, and was raised for our justification."